Welcome to The Next Turn, the home of conversations about skiing, ski racing, and sport. I'm your host, Martin Wilson, and after a lifetime as an athlete and a coach, and with a continuing love of skiing, I wanted to take a deep dive and have honest conversations with the sport's most successful athletes, coaches, and forward thinkers. So join me in my pursuit of better, to be better coaches, better athletes, better parents, and better fans. This week, a conversation with Eric Reed. Welcome back to The Next Turn. A big thanks to last week's guest, Jeff Lackey, for a super interesting conversation. And as always, thank you so much for liking, sharing, subscribing, rating, and reviewing this podcast wherever you're listening. We really appreciate it. And as always, I'm joined by two of my favorites, Jeff and Kara. Kara, how are you?
Hey guys, great to be here. Looking forward to tonight. At the age of 29, Canadian skier Eric Reed has been working hard and solidified himself as a contender on the World Cup. And according to the stats and the results, he's picking up some serious momentum. Eric comes from a serious line of ski racing lineage. His mom, Linda Robbins, was a member of the Canadian national ski team. And his dad is legendary Crazy Canuck, Ken Reed, winner of no less than 5 World Cup downhill races. I interviewed Ken Reed in Escarpment magazine last winter. This is just one of my other 11 jobs that I have. And he was my favorite interview to date. As a ski racing dad, he's got a unique perspective and insight, which obviously stems from his own career. Oftentimes you'll hear former athletes say that they want their kids to have a quote unquote normal life, because oftentimes the best, being the best comes with sacrifice. And for ski racing in particular, usually the sacrifice is related to education. All three of Ken's sons, Jeff, Kevin, and Eric, skied at the highest level while skiing NCAA and working towards an undergraduate degree. So I'm so interested in hearing Eric's words about some of his experiences with balancing school and skiing and finding out what's been working for him, because obviously something is working for him.
Pretty awesome to speak with Eric. He's a former NORAM champ, 2-time Canadian champ, NCAA champ, and the list goes on, World Cup long hauler. Went back to University of Denver at 23 years of age and continued to race in the World Cup while going to school, as Kara said. And he's one of Canada's only 2 World Cup tech skiers right now, him and his buddy, Trevor Philp, who he grew up kind of racing against. And I got to meet both of them at Red Mountain at Nationals. I was chief of course for men's in 2018, and like just a super great dude. And, you know, one of those guys that has to say hi to you every time he sees you, and so good to see him again. And it was a fantastic interview. Look forward to hearing what you two have to talk about.
For me, he's a super cool guy. He just really nice, really humble, incredibly smart. And it was really fun to talk to him. Like Kara said, about his NCAA experience and how he balanced both worlds, NCAA and World Cup. And he's gathered so much experience along the way from not only his family, but his teammates in the NCAA and on the national team. And he's coming into the sweet spot of his career. And he talks a little bit about that in the interview. I hope you all enjoy it. Here's Eric Reed on The Next Turn. Mr. Reed, how are you?
Not too shabby. How are you, Martin?
I'm great. Thanks so much for doing this, Eric. I really appreciate it. Where are you?
I'm in Kranjska-Gora.
When do you head over to Switzerland?
Wednesday, I believe. Wednesday, Thursday. Yeah. It's tough. There's a whole bunch of weather right now. So not rushing over that way quite yet.
Dodgy at best. Speaking of rough weather, last couple of days, huh?
Yeah. Well, honestly, just yesterday, like we got so lucky on Saturday.
Yeah.
For sure. Not the best racing conditions, but still good surface, beautiful sunny day. And then, yeah, yesterday crazy. And then today it's like gorgeous outside again. So of course the Kranjska-Gora slalom is a mess. Like it is almost annually.
Yeah. The good Lord giveth and taketh away there often, doesn't he? Since you're bringing it up on that subject, there's been a lot of talk about sets and surfaces this year, and some safety. I had Jan Hudek and Visa Kostelich on the other day, and they were talking about all this stuff, and asking for a better, safer athletes. Is that something that you even worry about, the sets and surface and things like that?
That's definitely something you're conscious of. I mean, at a performance level, you're really trying to like dial in your equipment and kind of predict what the snow will be like for your own race. But you look at what happened in Adelboden with like that many injuries, and of course it's on our mind. And then you have people kind of comparing one year of races to another year of races. So for sure it's there. And I think one thought as a potential solution that I think Fish should kind of take some initiative on is you have the race organizers preparing the race slope and for World Cup conditions, and we kind of know what to expect most of the time. So why are they not able to prepare the warm-up slope the same? And I think that's a great chance for Fish to come in and kind of set a standard. And so then you have that like kind of practice run on the conditions before you're throwing yourself down a hill full speed. You look at like F1 racing, and they have a chance to get out there on the track and test the tires and the vehicles. And that's a way for them to obviously hone in their performance for the race, but it's also a safety issue. And so I think like the skis and the equipment, like those are our tires. That's like what we need to have dialed in for the race. So set, like prepare the warm-up slope just like the race. And then I think you'll have less issues and also a more level playing field as far as like you have the Austrians or the Swiss with all the resources to prepare slopes like that all the time with greater success. So the smaller nations kind of are more on the back burner sometimes. So I definitely think that's a good topic of conversation these days, and I'm glad you brought it up right away. So,
well it's a big one, right? And I think a lot of it just comes, what you just said makes a lot of sense, and whether FIS hears you or not is a different subject, isn't it? Right? Like your idea is one thing, but do you have a platform to speak about it? Do you feel as an athlete you get much of a say? Part of what they were talking about a couple of weeks ago is that the national bodies have their own priorities and things that are important to them, which may not be the same as the actual athletes on the national teams. Do you see a distinction there between what's represented by the national bodies and what's the real needs and concerns of the athletes?
For sure. But I, at the same time, I think there are different pathways to voice those concerns. On any given day at a World Cup level, like, so this is just like day by day, we have an athlete rep that we can voice those concerns to. And a lot of the time that's more just kind of like any issue, safety issues you feel you have with the set or the conditions on that given day. Or for example, 4 years ago when that Kitzbühel race was canceled after 30 racers, when Axel and Svindal crashed and a few other guys, the athlete rep was consulted that day. I guess they actually said, we want the race to continue, but they ended up canceling at 30. That's an aside. So there is that pathway and that voice to be heard. We also do have two athlete reps who sit on the executive board, and that's Daniel Yule and Verena Stufer. And so it's maybe not as loud of a voice as it could be, but there is the pathway set up in FIS. Unfortunately, it's not always communicated and heard on their part. I think Jan Hudek was the one who brought that up on your last podcast, that like athletes have no voice. And I'm going to disagree. I don't think that's quite accurate, because we also do have two athlete reps with a vote who sit on FIS council. Mm-hmm. So, it's definitely not as loud a microphone as I think it should be, but we do have our voices heard.
Do you feel protected as an athlete as far as your livelihood? I think part of what they were saying, and it makes sense to me, is that if something happens to them, they're sort of, if an athlete gets injured, they're quickly replaced on the World Cup tour. And there's not much insurance for those athletes that are injured over the recovery time. If it's a career-ending injury, you still have to put food on your table, right? Do you feel protected like that? Or you feel like you're in the Wild West and you're looking after yourself?
I would say I kind of land in the middle for sure. I don't have that same insurance policy that I feel like a professional athlete has, like being on a salary. But at the same time, I usually, like, at least in Canada, if you have an injury, they take you through the full rehab process, like regardless of if it's like a career ending injury or if you're just getting back to the next World Cup. And as well as support, like through services and that the government is able to provide. So there are, it's not like we're being fully left out to dry, but at the same time, for sure, it's, if a bad crash happens and you can't compete for a year, then yeah, you're not able to really make any income at that point. You're just, working your way back, and hopefully you have other pursuits in mind at that time, or other thoughts about your future, which partially is why I did the NCAA route, which I think we'll chat about in our conversation. But I think that's definitely something you have to be conscious of as a World Cup athlete, that you don't have that same safety necessarily that some other professional sports do.
Interesting. That's great. Let's talk about the NCAA. You graduated from the University of Denver 2017, correct?
I officially graduated 2018, but my skiing career with them ended in 2017.
Fair enough. And you have a business degree and you were pretty smart, 4.0 GPA, correct?
Yeah, that's true.
That's got to give you some protection if the skiing career comes to an end at any point, right? So do you manage your career as a business?
Partially. I think you do have to be able to step outside of it. You can't have skiing so intertwined with your identity that the ups and downs of the day to day, the good races, the bad races, like affect who you are as a person. So I do think you need that separation from it. And also it is just one part of your life, right? Like your athletic career is going to end at 30, 35, maybe 40. That's kind of the upper range that you see these days. And then life goes on. So for me personally, when I finished high school, I did my SATs right away. I had school on my mind. Finally bit the bullet when I was 23 and then did the 3 years of NCAA and finished off that fourth year. And yeah, skiing is my passion. I love it. And I'm doing, like, throwing everything I can at it. Especially kind of this coming up this Olympic year, it's like I'm coming into my prime. I'm at where I really feel like I can be the most competitive as far as my age and my career. So it's a passion, but at the same time, you do have to step back from it.
I want to talk about that sweet spot that you're coming into in your career as far as experience and maturity and all that stuff. But for a second, I'd like you to go back to when you're 17, 18 years a senior in high school. Where were you in your skiing career and what were the options laid in front of you as far as the national team pathway and the NCAA pathway? Could you talk us through that few year period? You didn't go to college until you were 23, correct? Mm-hmm. So you had a few years there. What'd you do with those years? And what was the catalyst to go, wait, I need to go to university for a while?
Yeah. So, I mean, I come from a family where we really prioritize education. Both my parents did it, balancing through ski racing. I think my dad, he retired at 27, was racing World Cup, one of the crazy Canucks. I think he only had 1 year where he wasn't attending the Western University. So that was definitely something they instilled upon me. Like I said, I graduated from high school and wrote my SATs right away. So kind of that was my first year. And then every year after that, I was doing just a couple spring courses at University of Calgary or Mont Royal University. So it was something that was always kind of working towards a goal. I was actually, I would say, tracking pretty well, trending well as far as a ski racing path. I won the NORAM title in 2012 for the first time. So that puts me, I think I was 20 years old at the time. And so I felt like I was like ready to kind of move on to the World Cup circuit. And that was right when the ski change happened from the 27 meters to the 35, as well as Super G and downhill. And I struggled so bad with that. It was it was nightmarish, like to see how I went from winning NORAMs like 6 points to basically tripling them in a year, finding no success on World Cup, 6 seconds out in Adelboden on the first run, stuff like that. So that I mean, World Cup is a reality check. I think a lot of North Americans face that coming off the NORAM circuit. So that hit me hard with the ski change in there too, especially kind of racing World Cup on 35s, going back to NORAMs, racing on the 27 meters. So things were going well up until that point. And that's where I really kind of came back down, and then had a few years where I was building again, but not really breaking through, not really kind of jumping onto the World Cup circuit like I was watching some of my peers doing at that time. So in 2014, in January, I finally reached out to some of the colleges and said, hey, I'm interested. I was still with the national team at that time, but watching my NCAA clock and looking like I'm going to start losing years. So I wasn't making it onto World Cup, and I decided, you know, it's almost like a safety net. And at the same time, cause I still believe in myself. I still love ski racing. So to go to school and be like, hey, I have 2-3 more years guaranteed if I go this pathway. And I talked to the high performance director of the time with Alpine Canada, laid it all out that this is what I wanted to do. And luckily Trevor Philp, my current teammate, he'd been there a couple of years and was finding success NORAMs and then into World Cup. So I finally pulled trigger in 2014, went down to Denver, and scored World Cup points that first fall. And I've got some theories on why that finally happened then, but it was something as far as kind of like what you're talking about, like what's my mindset through it. It was something I always considered. I had that plan where I finished high school right away, wrote the SATs, and was kind of just seeing where a scheme would take me, but knew that this was something that was on the plate the whole time.
Mm-hmm. I want to hear about your theories of why you were successful. I've been a college and university coach a couple times in my career. I happen to think that the NCAA is probably the best athletic feeder system in the world. And when a sport uses the NCAA for further development, it seems to just about always work. That's my theory of it, because you get 4 years to develop, to be more well-rounded, be more mm-hmm. mature, put things in perspective a bit. That's my theory. What's your theory on what made it work? As soon as you got to Denver, things started clicking. You said you got your first World Cup points just about right away when you got to Denver. What's your theory?
So I totally agree with you there that NCAA can be used as a great pathway. It isn't for everybody though. It does require quite a balance between school and athletics, and that's something each individual person would have to kind of come to terms with on themselves. And then you also have prodigies who just fly through the system, and I don't think NCAA is right for them either. But for me, I kind of already touched upon it, but I was so consumed in ski racing, because that was kind of the only thing I had going in my life for years, that when I had the chance to kind of focus on something else, it brought this new energy and this new freedom back into my skiing. Cause when I started in that first fall, and I was down in Ushuaia and I missing the first 2 weeks of school. And it was a grind, cause I barely could get internet connection and, just struggling to get the first few assignments in on top of managing this new lifestyle, balancing both. And it was hard at first. I wasn't skiing as much. I was definitely putting a lot more energy, losing sleep over my school. But then when I finished that first quarter, in November, I came back skiing and I was so fast, just cause I was loving it again. And that's where, I got into like, yeah, some good races at the start and built into my first World Cup points right away. So I think it really helps you kind of, take a different perspective on the sport. And that is something I'm trying to use even today, just not to the same extent because it turned into a grind at that point.
I bet. There's more than a handful of athletes right now in the World Cup in the top 30 that have gone the NCAA route. Can you talk a little bit about the coordination and what has to happen between in your case, Alpine Canada and the University of Denver? How do those negotiations happen about your schedule? I got to think that you have to take the lead on coordinating these things and really pushing the direction here. Do you find you had willing partners on both sides? And talk a little bit about what those struggles in coordination are and what support you got and what support you wish you had more of.
Mm-hmm. That's a great question. And I think it's so dependent on which national organization you're talking about. You look at the Norwegians who they're happy to let their athletes go and do their 3-4 years of NCAA, but they don't really support them that much during that time. It's just kind of like, hey, you go do this. If you come out of it with like good points and fast skiing, we'll take you on, we'll give you an opportunity, but after, which is a little bit different than someone like the Austrians who really don't want that pathway to work. And we kind of see that with my buddy Tobias Kogler right now. But Alpine Canada, just because we don't have the same depth in our sheer number of athletes, I think they have been more open to working like with that system, especially through like monetary budget issues that we've had over the years. Maybe with Phil now, it might be a different stance on it. I think we're going to find out this spring. It comes from the athlete that you really have to sit down with both parties. I found that the university, like with the coaches and stuff like that, at least at Denver, were really keen to make it work. On the Alpine Canada side, it definitely takes a bit more talking too. But my year where I was like trying to break, like do most of the World Cup circuit in NCAA, I sat them both down. Like, we have to come up with a plan like ahead of time so we don't find ourselves in any compromising situations. And so that involved like which races I was going to be attending like throughout the year. And so what ended up happening is come January, when I'd scored 2 World Cup top 10s and was consistently getting in there every weekend, I raced Adelboden and I had to go skip Wengen the next weekend to go race college races because you needed that minimum for the championship. And they weren't happy about that, but it was something we had both agreed to ahead of time. And so I went back, I did my college races, came back for Kitzbühel the next weekend and actually came 7th in the slalom. So it definitely comes through ownership and the initiative through the athlete, but it's possible. And open communication and dialogue, especially trying to work with both parties because they do have very different interests at heart. And those conflicts will come up. So, I mean, as best you can do if you have that plan before.
Amen. Proper prior planning, right?
Yeah. What a surprise.
We'll be right back.
Don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe wherever you're listening to this podcast. And as always, share your thoughts of the day with us at thenextturnpodcast.com. Follow us on Facebook and Instagram at thenextturnpodcast. Now back to our conversation with Canadian skier Eric Reed on The Next Turn.
Talk about your ownership piece and your, as a coach, we always try to instill some ownership in athletes so they can take the lead. I think it's a lot easier to push an athlete than to turn around and pull them. So getting behind an athlete and following their lead is super important. Can you talk about your evolution in ownership when you started to take, was it just because you went to university and then you had to take care of your shit, or was it an evolution? And did it change once you left NCAA and back to the national team, or do you just take care of everything now and use the resources of Alpine Canada as you see fit?
It's definitely an evolution because you come out of your lower levels of racing, get through the system, like the club, the provincial or the regional team, and then onto the national team. And at first, especially for me, in my first couple of years, I kind of assumed that everything that was laid out to me was what I needed. Mm-hmm. Like the dry land program, the skiing, everything, that this is like a national team level and it's what will allow me to succeed. And I think over the years, that's something I realized that it isn't. It's definitely a lot of pieces there, but you really have to know what you need as an athlete. It's probably going to sound cliche, but it's the adversity. That's where you learn the most about yourself and where you get the most ownership. I was dropped from the team in 2015 or 2016, one of those years. And that's where I was on my own. And I learned more about myself as far as my ski racing needs than any other year. So it's like those moments where, to put it simply, like you can tell an athlete however many times that they need to do a proper warm up before they go out and do their training or something like that, but they don't really own it until they have a back injury and then they realize how much they need it. Right. So I think like you can tell an athlete or point them in the right direction, but they really have to come to that realization themselves. And, some people get there sooner than others. Maybe some not at all. So, it was just those like kind of those moments throughout my career where I really took more ownership and realization over what I needed as a ski racer. And I can definitely try and pass that on as best I can to the next generation and the communities that support me. But when it comes down to it, like ski racing is such an individual sport where you have to work with what your body, like how it is and like mentally and physically. And the point I'm at now, I look at my year, and if there's pieces missing, then I go out and I seek those. My mentality towards skiing these days is like, if there's something I need, it doesn't matter what the cost is. It's an investment in my, into my future and my career. So, it's about making those decisions based off of what will allow me to succeed as a ski racer instead of like what the costs are going to be or something like that, right? Like the things that maybe make you stop short before. So I'm sure as a human being, I'm maturing, but throughout the years as an athlete, and school was one of those great things where I was having to balance my time and my energy and my focus, and learn pretty quick how to do that in an environment like that.
That's awesome. One more question about NCAA and then we'll move on. I find it incredibly rewarding to be in an NCAA team because it is a team. Mm-hmm. And it relieves a little bit of individual pressure, but it also makes you step up because you're responsible for your teammates as well. Is that sort of the biggest takeaway that you had from your NCAA time? Is just you mentioned the decompression and the balance between it all, but the NCAA team culture versus the national team culture, those are two different animals. Am I wrong? And what are the two pros and cons of both, I guess?
Yeah. Well, I mean, if you can it just shows you how important culture is for what your goal, your ultimate goal is. I can tell you that I've never been more nervous before a ski race than the NCAA championships, because it's not just your individual performance, like you said, right? You have the team on your back and you need to do your part. I was able to thrive in that environment and put up some good results. And I got a one championship ring, which I'm super proud of. But yeah, it's totally different being in a high performance national team versus the college environment. And for sure, ideally you can kind of take both and meld them together, because they're, like you said, there's going to be pros and cons to both. Like the national team is so singularly focused on medals that they're not necessarily doing the best job, like developing athletes and stuff like that. Especially ones that aren't kind of trending well. Whereas like the college, it's maybe a little too relaxed at sometimes. Like you really have to have a strong team leader at the time to bring everyone together for that motivation, so they're not kind of skipping workouts or staying up late studying or obviously the whole social scene there. So yeah, it's for sure. It's like I got exposed to both. So I'm trying to take the bits and pieces that worked, for both, environments, and now apply it to a World Cup level, where it's totally different now. Luckily Trevor also went through the college system, but, I mean, I highly recommend it, cause it's also part of, your like growing as a human being, like going to university, getting those experiences. Right. And so, I think that's something I feel like I didn't miss out on either. And I'm glad I went that pathway, had that team environment, working together with another sport as well to come to that ultimate goal of winning a championship. And now to be in a high performance level where I'm living together with these guys for 7 months. We've been on the road now, which is kind of crazy. And how do you bring that kind of fun that you have at the college level to this like super serious, World Cup, every race, every weekend counts.
It's hard. Like it's hard to put it in perspective, yeah, and keep it in perspective, isn't it?
Yeah. And I mean, this year it's even tougher with like COVID and everything, right? Like we all have our single rooms and, like I haven't been home since September. So it's so hard not to fall just like into the grind. I think that's something I didn't manage super well this year. So, looking to improve always.
I want to switch gears a little bit, if you don't mind, and talk about skiing and good skiing. I think you are probably one of the most technically precise skiers on the World Cup. I think you are incredibly smooth. And I think that's the rap that you have, is that you're technically perfect, but may not have the gas at times, or it appears that way. And when you're really good, it seems super perfect. In some ways, I think of you as a, you may like this, as a male Mikaela Shiffrin, because you're so efficient with your movements. You don't have to create these huge aggressive edge angles because you're picking up the ski so cleanly at the beginning. How far am I off with that analysis of your skiing in your mind?
Yeah, you're pretty damn close. And I mean, the only correction I'll put is when you said good skiing at the start, because what matters is fast skiing at the World Cup, right?
Amen. My bad.
So, yeah, that is a very accurate depiction of my skiing. And I've always heard I have this touch and this efficiency on snow that I'm not doing all these crazy moves. And for sure, that's a huge advantage of mine. But at the same time, like you said, sometimes when it's a ragged course, you just need that aggression and to throw yourself down the hill and create that speed.
How do you make good skiing fast skiing? Is it like, how do you learn how to send?
That's a lot of trust in yourself. And something I've worked at over the years with my sports psych, and I'm still not quite there, but, what another great thing that I do in ski racing is when I do push on the ski in the fall line, I get a ton of zip out of the turn. So it's really like trust that when you put yourself out there, when you throw yourself down the hill, when you're at the top of a turn and have to kind of take that chance, that risk, that it's going to work out, right? Because 99 times out of 100, it will. And so why come into a turn sitting back and passive when that's not fast ski racing? And that's where the repetition and the trust starts to build up when you do it again and again and again, and then you're able to do it in a race environment when you only have that one shot. So that's something, I mean, I think every ski racer is working on, and there's still conditions I'm not comfortable in. And it's that much harder to like fight my instinct. Like, we were talking this year in Adelboden, cause it was a very simple set, easy snow. And a lot of the time when you get up to that speed, you start to throw these little drifts in, and it's not necessary. You're fighting your instinct. And so it's really about having that plan and that intention at the start of the day or the start of that next run to to throw yourself down the hill, trust it. And yeah, it's fun.
Specifically when you're working with your sports psychologist, I hope you don't mind me asking, but how do you work on building trust in yourself, trust in your equipment, trust in your abilities? How do you do that? Or do you just go up there and trust myself? Or are there steps along the way to prove it to yourself?
Without getting too nitty gritty into the details of what my sports psych and I talk about, it's about having that kind of like mental toolbox and that plan at the start, where a big part of it is like you're stepping in a start gate, and that next run, how much does it really matter in the grander scheme of things, right? As a person and my identity, that next run, if I go out, if I ski super fast, like it's not going to change anything. So why not just throw yourself down the hill, take that chance, take that leap of faith and see what happens. And, that starts off in training. You can't just do it in a race with the pressure there, but you do get to a point where you're able to bring it right away. So, and I don't know if you're picking it up, but I'm kind of using little keywords and that, help you work towards that goal. Where in the end it really does come about trusting yourself and why not? It's kind of like, screw it. It's,
A lot of the athletes we've spoken with, and I think all great athletes get to the point where they become very present, right? And that's what you're talking about. It's like, this run, good or bad, is not going to change who I am and my identity. So mm-hmm. It's, in some ways, it's about skiing and living almost consequence-free. Mm-hmm. Does that make sense? So how do you, can you train like that? Like when you're looking for a good day of training, do you sort of ease into it, or to the first run you're going full send? How do you, racing's training. How do you transition from one to the other, those lessons that you're learning and feeling? You're talking about repetitions. There's mm-hmm. race repetitions and there's training repetitions. How do you bring those together?
Yeah, that's a great question. Definitely individualize how you come to the conclusion, because I always heard about Herman Meyer when he was coming onto the scene, and it was the summer training when, like, it really doesn't matter if you're skiing fast or if you're throwing yourself down the hill. A lot of teams focus on technical work, but I guess he was just throwing everything he could at that next run. And people were like, hey, like, come on, you don't need to be doing this. But then he continued that throughout the whole summer and then into the fall and then into the World Cup race season. So that's what worked for him. That was the mental attitude he took, where I'm going to win that next run, whatever it is, whenever.
You've had some really good results. You've had some highs and lows. You've won some runs, right? What, when you look at going forward, you talked about getting into the sweet spot of your career. What's it going to take for you to go from being where you are to that next level where you get out there and maybe you're there now in your own mind where you're expecting to win, expecting to podium each time you're out there, but how do you go from where, how do you level up just that little bit more, a little bit more? Is it something physically? Is it all mental? Like when you plan for next year and the next couple of years, where do you get that 1-2% more?
Yeah, I think you say it right. It is only a little 1-2%. And those are the questions I think I'm going to be asking myself and sitting down with my team to come up with some answers. I can already tell you that the last few years, because that's something I can reflect on and see where the progression of my skiing's gone. I went from someone who couldn't, who was fast at the norm level, couldn't replicate that at World Cup conditions, slowly gained confidence, how to build my setup and how to ski these World Cup hills, where I started to score points and then I started to score them more regularly. And for a few years there, I was really just about like getting the start gate and throw myself down the hill, see what happens. And the problem was a lot of the more challenging conditions, my instincts were fighting that a little too much, I think. But I was actually gotten to a point where I was able to compete better than I was training. And now this past season, I've trained so well pretty much the entire time that my expectation of what I can do at a race changed. And I think that that kind of bit me in the ass a bit this year, where I was having my most consistent season and the world championships came along, and I had this higher expectation. I was still training well. And yeah, I came out with too much pressure on myself in the end. In a bad start, I ended up hip sliding in the first run of that race. But I think I learned a lot about myself and kind of that next step and that mental attitude that the champions of our sport have had to, or had to foster for themselves. And so, yeah, I don't have an answer for you now. What's kind of next? I think it is just all of these little different pieces. It's a little more focus on certain things in the gym. Like for myself, that long lever stability. So like putting your foot out there and being able to push and support that. Like, so a lot of the time I might get a little backseat. So I want to help rectify that in the gym. It's being a bit more honed in with the conditions, and because I struggled a bit with my equipment this year at times. And so it's just all these little pieces that add up. And I think I mentioned before that this is an Olympic year and I kind of want to just throw everything I can at it and see where I end up. But I truly believe that I'm still taking those steps forward. And I just had my most consistent season where I'm about to head off to the World Cup finals for the first time. So I think that's a small victory, and you really do have to focus on those because this sport is ruthless. You can have, like, I didn't have a single result all of February after a great December and early January. And that's just ski racing.
Yeah, you better give yourself a high five when you can, huh?
Exactly.
Talk about that equipment piece. How much are you focused on that equipment? No, let me rephrase that. Every World Cup athlete is super particular. They can feel everything underneath them, sort of princess in the pea. And you talked about it earlier. It all comes down to that connection to the snow, right? The outside ski to the snow, and that connection is everything, and everything else from there is just makes it better, I guess. How much do you play with equipment? What's the criteria? And I guess specifically when you go into a place like Kranjska Gora and you know that you could have every different weather in a matter of 48 hours, how big is your quiver and what's in your quiver?
Yeah. So when I was first coming on to World Cup, there was a few Canadian athletes who I think went a little too crazy testing different things with equipment. So there's certain things that I don't go there. And that's like, if there's all these options for boots or like power straps or like different ramp angles and stuff like that, I say, if what I have is working pretty well, then don't change it that much. And focus on what does matter. For me, personally, I think edge prep for what the conditions are going to be on any given day is one of the most important things. And I don't think I'm the only one. You look at Hersher in the Olympics in the slalom, and you could tell that he hadn't figured it out for that day. And on a side note, they were going crazy the days leading up to that race to find that perfect setup. So that's probably something that like you said, every World Cup athlete is dealing with. So for one, it's exposure to the right kinds of conditions, leading into a race. And so I know what I like and what I will expect to feel if I have like this World Cup injection ice, or if it's, like an aggressive snow in Beaver Creek, or if it's, salted spring-like snow you so often see in January, especially slaloms and stuff like that, what we just saw in Kranjska Gora the other day. So my approach has always been, I kind of know this rain, these few different snow conditions I'll expect to feel, and hopefully I have a plan for each and what to do. And that can be a couple of different ski models, different ways to prep the edge. I use the machine most of the time with my ski man, but it's about finding that right balance, because a lot of the time you're going to be out of a race right away if you don't have enough grip. But at the same time, what I learned this year is I had too much grip for the slalom at World Championships, which I was expecting to be peely, and it was still aggressive. So there's definitely a sweet spot. And I think some athletes can operate in a bigger bandwidth of what that sweet spot is. And it's just experience over the years, and hopefully having a good relationship, especially with the ski manufacturers, to help you come to that that point where you know what that sweet spot is for you.
We'll be right back.
As always, we want to say thank you to our friends at 4951. Check them out at 4951.com for all your Liski, gait, training, and safety needs. And now back to our conversation with Eric Reed on the next turn.
I got to think that the evolution of your relationship with coaches over time has changed. What you require, what you desire from those coaches and need from them, it's got to be different now than it was before. Mm-hmm. On a training day, on a race day, what is your interaction with the coaches? What do they give you? What are you asking for from them? How does that play?
Yeah. I mean, they'll probably hate to hear this, but on race day, they're not that important.
That's fair. As a coach, I totally agree. Like race, yeah. If we do it right and we prep right, race day is a day that I get to kick back and watch and cheer.
Yeah, exactly. So, at this point in my career, what I expect from my coaches is to create the training environment that will most closely simulate a World Cup race. And so that's especially the surface that we train on, the slopes and stuff like that. Cause a lot of my own technical work, it's kind of more of a, almost like a filter where I know what I need as an athlete, and the coaches are giving me their feedback. And I can kind of use that in a way that makes sense for my skiing now, as opposed to just kind of taking their word for everything. And I think that's what I've really grown into, and NCAA actually helped me with that as well, because I was changing coaches all the time. So you can't really just go ahead and listen to everything that's being thrown at you. So that as far as a coach goes, that's where that evolution's gone. The ski man, who I think is the arguably the most important person in a ski racer's career. That's where they kind of, when you first start working with someone, you're both, coming up with ideas that you think will work, things to try. But as you get kind of closer into the season or over the years with them, you're kind of at a point where, you come to the same conclusions, I guess, or if not, I take a lot of ownership over my equipment. So if I want something, I'll say it, and he'll work in that, that kind of atmosphere where he might make little suggestions or something like that, but he knows that as an athlete, like I need to have trust in my equipment, and I take ownership over those decisions. So that's kind of, where I'm at there. And as far as like, ski manufacturers, I think at this point I'm worked 2 years with Atomic. It's an amazing support team that they have there with the racing department. And it's really about what they do is they're able to look at all their athletes on the product and see what's working and see what the setups are, and kind of working to like a common theme that all their athletes use in the equipment, so that it's not just like one person performing, but it's the whole group performing, because you've all kind of used your own different environments and training over the years and through the summer to come to the best models and the best way to set up the skis and stuff like that. So in the end it comes back to that ownership thing where really it's about my career now at this point, and I can use all these resources that are here to support me, not as I see fit, but as needed.
I like that. That's what it all, like, yeah, you got to get what you need at the end of the day, mm-hmm. right? I want to switch gears one more time as we near the end here. I want to talk about your family legacy. And the upsides and downsides. Obviously, your dad was one of the Crazy Canucks, leader of the Crazy Canucks, some would say. Incredible career, World Cup wins. Your mother was an incredible skier as well. You've got one brother on the World Cup. You have another brother that's really good. You've had aunts and uncles, and it's the Reed family skis. I can imagine that meant that you just got put in the deep end right away. but also with a lot of love and support in that environment. What's the biggest thing you get from your parents and their experience and the environment that they created over time in the ski world for you and your brothers?
I think two parts. For one, skiing was a family activity from a young age for me. So I had countless hours when I was young, because that's just what we did. We went skiing as a family over the weekend. And at that age, it's not about the training and the sport specific skills. It's just about time on snow. So I was very fortunate that's what I did with my family. And I came and grew to love the sport from it. And I still carry that love and passion for it today. And as far as now, I was also fortunate that my dad and parent, both parents, actually, they made sure this was my career. So they took a step back from it and never really pushed, as far as the coaching side or anything like that. Which for some athletes, I guess, like Michaela Schifrin or Hersher, you see their parents right there. But at the same time, it was my career, but I can still rely on them as, especially my dad as like a role model and a key figure to bounce ideas off of that, isn't so nitty gritty into the daily workings of skiing. So any big picture stuff, we have conversations about big decisions, stuff like that. And he's been through it all. So, he's been through it all as a ski racer, as the CEO of Alpine Canada on the FIS, as a broadcaster. So he's seen so many different facets of the sport. And so he has that whole wealth of knowledge to tap into. And, I'm so lucky that, I have that resource in my skiing career. So, super grateful for them. And, me and my brother, the middle one is now like a ski talker out there. Well, with more Instagram followers and blowing
he's
up
got
on
strong Insta game, man. I so love his stuff.
He might be the most successful out of all of us.
He's got great stuff. Kevin's stuff is awesome. I love it.
Yeah. Maybe there's too many dinner time conversations about ski racing, and that drove a few girls out of the house who couldn't stand it. But yeah, my family lives and breathes ski racing, and that's kind of just the way it is. And I'm glad that I grew into that passion myself.
Well, we're glad you did too, honestly. Like, and as a Canadian living in the States now, but as a Canadian, I think your family has done so much for skiing and sport in the country. So I thank you for all that you've done across the board. Before we go, when you look back at your childhood days, or maybe when you look forward to the day that you have your own children and they get into the sport, what's the biggest piece to keep kids in it and breed this sport and the love of the sport? What was it for you? You said it was your a little bit of your family. It was just what you did. But that's the start of it. How do you keep up that momentum and the development skiing wise, emotionally wise, and love wise for the sport? How do you keep that up along the way?
I mean, it just has to keep, it has to be fun. I think when it comes down to it, it has to be something that people want to do, in their free time, that it's not just about going and training on the weekends, but it's about maybe doing a little bit of training, but then also shredding with your buddies afterwards. And I think that's what creates good skiers, and that's what creates a great community. And ultimately, if we have enough people doing that, we're going to have fast ski racers representing our nations, and for us, Canada, well, at the World Cup level. I think it's a question a lot of sports are coming to grasp with these days, where you have these hyper-focused parents and just grinding their kids at a young age, and maybe you find a certain amount of success, but there's so much burnout too at the same time. I think we're incredibly lucky that the sport is one of the most beautiful canvases you can paint, where you just go out there and you shred your turns on some fresh corduroy, look like a kink in your neck because you've just been looking around at the scenery. I think it's, when it comes down to it, it's pretty amazing what I get to do and what I grew up just skiing around the world, and how much fun it is, as opposed to, you know, staring at the bottom of a swimming pool or something like that. So I think it's a great community in that sense that can really foster a lot of lifelong friendships and a lot of soft skills and that help take you into the rest of life. I know a lot of ski racers that I've come across with at the college level and stuff like that have really excelled in different avenues of life afterwards. And I think a lot of the time they bring up how important ski racing was as one of those stepping stones to get to where they are today.
We'll be right back with our thoughts of the day. Welcome back. Special thanks to Eric Reed for an incredible conversation. Thank you so much for his insight and honesty. We really appreciate it. Hope you liked it too. It's now time for our thoughts of the day. Kara, what you thinking?
Another great interview, guys. One takeaway for me is one of the most important, in my opinion, evolutionary steps taken by Alpine Canada was the paradigm shift, where they now see NCAA skiing as an opportunity rather than a distraction or the loss of a talented athlete, right? Eric speaks about his growth as an athlete as a byproduct of his collective experiences. And he's one of the success stories that came out of the NCAA system. And he's living proof that you don't have to sacrifice everything, and including education, in order to be a world-class skier. But, and this is a big but, it requires patience and flexibility from the governing body. The patience to give the athlete time and the flexibility to mold the athletic program to work with the demands of the university. And I think what ACA ultimately discovered is that this stream offers an array of extra resources for athletes that they can tap into that'll benefit their ski racing. And we're seeing that with Eric. I mean, he says that. As I mentioned in the opener, I interviewed Eric's dad, Ken Reed, and we talked a lot about the importance of outside pursuits for athletes. And for Ken, hilariously, it was also education, if you can believe it. And keep in mind, this is back in the 1970s and 80s when he was competing on the World Cup. He attended classes each spring and slowly worked towards his undergraduate degree. He said he often missed the first on-snow training of the season, which is unheard of at the time. But he said it made his training opportunities even more valuable. So listening to this interview, I was immediately struck by how Eric's outlook is so much similar to his dad's, when he said that some exceptional talents will shoot straight through the pathway to the top, but there are only a handful of those guys. Most athletes have to work diligently year after year and gaining the experience and strength and maturity and chipping their way to the top. The NCAA provides athletes with the time to grow while giving them an invaluable education and the chance to lead like somewhat of a normal life. So my takeaway is that clearly these Reed boys are cut from the same cloth. And as Ken said to me, his own words, the university experience created an ethos of excellence while being a welcome break from the rigors of training. And 40 plus years later, it seems to be working for Eric.
I like that, the ethos of excellence. That's really good. And the more things change, the more things sound the same, don't they? Jeff, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, Martin, as I said earlier, and certainly I echo a lot of what Kara just said, but I got to sit down with with Eric and Trevor in 2018 at Nationals and had dinner with them and knew right away how, you know, articulate and bright both those guys are and committed to their sport, as you talked about in the interview. I love how focused he is and how passionate he is about it and how he's doing everything he can to make it. I love the fact that he went back to school at 23 and finished his university degree. I think he's everything we want in human beings in our sport, right? You and I talk about it all the time. Part of your job as coaches, and this for the young coaches out there, you're not only coaching young athletes, you're trying to mold them into great humans. And certainly Eric Reed is a great human being, and I wish him nothing but success on the World Cup. And he had a great start to the season this year and kind of a crazy year, as we all know. So hopefully next year, better things to come for Eric. Martin, what are your thoughts of the day?
I think you both are spot on. I think he is an incredibly thoughtful, smart, and balanced human. I loved his honesty and how he just really was fair about where he is in his career, what he needs to do, and how he got to where he is. I think there's so much to be said, and we'll get to it in future episodes, about the NCAA route versus the World Cup route and what the pros and cons are, both of those. I loved his insight on that. I loved how he got ownership of his program through the NCAA and how that helped him. He is an incredible skier. He is coming into the sweet spot of his career, as he talked about, and I can't help but think that he's going to find that next 1 or 2% that he's talking about. He is so close. He is so ready. He is so prepared. Fingers crossed, and I'll be cheering for him as loud as I can. That's where I'm sitting. So thank you all for listening. I really appreciate you being here. We'll see you all soon back here on The Next Turn. Be well.